Stay calm, don't panic. You got this.
Hey guys, welcome back to the podcast. This is Chris Roby, and across from me is Carly Duke.
Hey guys.
So this week and next week, we're going to engage in our very first two-parter, which is really exciting.
Yeah, we have so much information. We couldn't fit it into one week.
It's a lot of stuff. So we had the opportunity to interview two different guests on the same topic, and both guests have different perspectives, because one kind of comes from the academic world, and that's this week's interview with Dr. Becky Taylor from TCU, Texas Christian University, here in Fort Worth. And then next week, we will interview Leslie Culver, and she covers lots of topics, but a lot about dealing with the family who's lost the loved one, mm-hmm. and what's kind of called postvention. And we'll talk about that some next week. But Dr. Taylor this week, she really gets into some of the whys behind why someone might take their life, about populations, specifically teenagers, some of the things that they deal with specifically. And it's a really, really awesome interview.
Yeah, we're excited to have Dr. Taylor with us and her insight and just what she has seen. I think you're going to really enjoy her interview, what she has to say, and just a different perspective that she brings to this topic.
And I'd say, too, just as a note about Dr. Taylor, with our organization, Teen Life, Dr. Taylor was integral in getting us started and helping us write our curriculum, and is a big thrust behind kind of the philosophy of what we do with teenagers. And so it was really cool to be able to sit down with her in her office, this like beautiful office, and mm-hmm. overlooks part of TCU. So really enjoy this interview. This was really enjoyable for us. Check in after the interview for some follow-up piece and some wrap-up. We'll see you after the interview. Hey guys, welcome back to the podcast. Carly and Chris here with Dr. Becky Taylor on TCU's campus in Fort Worth. We're really glad to be here. We're going to talk today about suicide, about some risk factors, and just we're going to really dive into it with an expert. So, Dr. Taylor, thank you for your time today and your awesome office. I love this place. So let's start a little bit about talking about what drives a person to contemplate suicide. Talk a little bit about that as we get started.
There's a lot of things that can cause the a person to start thinking about it. One of them is just that when, especially adolescents, they start realizing that death is a possibility, and even as early as fifth grade, kids start thinking about death in a different way than they have in their earlier lives. But as they get older, when things happen. We have possibilities of how we're going to react and how will we handle this. And if there has been a suicide of a close relative or a friend, they're more likely to consider that as a possibility. Huh. And so I think we always have to be really cognizant of whether or not this person has had someone close to them take their lives. Some of those issues that can cause people to start thinking along that line usually have to do with loss. So it might be the loss of a friend or the loss of a close relative. It could be a loss in terms of parents getting a divorce. Sometimes it's loss of health. A person is much more prone to taking their lives if they are ill and not feeling well and not in top shape. Sometimes people recovering from injuries tend to think along that lines because it's so slow. They may have lost things as a result of their injury. For example, a football player may have been the star on the team, but then he, hurts his knees, out for the season. He's not going to be able to play. And he may see that as a loss that he can't recover from. And so you have to look at it from their standpoint, but also that physical health can make a big difference. Another issue that kind of adds some real it creates more lethality is whether or not they're using alcohol and drugs. I think there's like a 50% rate of 50% of the people who take their lives are often using alcohol or drugs, and people don't think clearly. Alternatives don't seem available to them, so they are kind of one-sided. Of course, there's other things like just other personal issues, bullying, feeling like you don't fit in, not having a space where you feel like you can be safe and talk with people and feel like people care about you. But I think one of the biggest factors in my mind always is knowing someone who's taken their lives can be such a risk factor that that becomes an option that maybe they wouldn't have considered otherwise.
Wow, I never considered that being such a major thing. Like actually, you have seen it before, because you'd almost assume that having seen it. But I guess as a teenager, though, you're not seeing the fallout as much of that person taking their life, and that being an option. Is there any kind of genetic or pre-existing condition you would point to that, or has been discussed or shown as being? And I don't know if that's something that's been studied. That might make a person predisposed to something like this?
Well, the closest I can get to that is having a relative who did that.
Yeah.
So you tend to see it in families where, you know, in fact, in one situation, I know the son took his life. Then his father took his life about a year later. And then the an older brother also he had the death by cop where he set himself up to be shot by the policeman. So I think suicide can run in families like that. And so, you know, if you're a child and your father took his life, then that might be one of the first things you think about. This is what dad did. And of course there's such a strong environmental influence on that and how the family handles it. Well, that will make a big difference in whether or not, you know, that is a real serious consideration.
So what does a cry for help look like from a suicidal individual? Like what, as a helper, as a teacher, parent, what should we be listening for as a cry for help?
I think those things about those that sense of helplessness or hopelessness where they talk about, I don't feel like I matter anymore, or I don't have any friends, nobody cares about me. This is I can't do anything else. This is it. You know, I think those feelings of sadness will come out, but also just that hopeless talk. You know, I don't know if I can go on. That's often a common statement. Nothing I ever do works out. I don't think I can take this. Just anything where it seems like they are taking away their future. There's nothing available to them, no options. And that's really kind of the ending part of it. But also just, you know, noting their feelings of depression, or they're looking sad. They don't have the energy level. Or on the flip side, they suddenly have this energy after having been so depressed. And then that's kind of that's a serious sign that maybe they have a plan. And so I think always addressing it is important. The anger, when people are angry and sad, that's another sign that they could take aggression either against others or themselves. And so it's really important to talk about that with a person.
Is it relief? You talked about there being that burst of energy after being sad. Is it relief having a plan?
Right. They feel like, okay, now I've got a plan. This is going to work out because I won't have to deal with this anymore. So there's a weird kind of hope, you know, that it's going to end. And rather than seeing it as something that will end over time, they see it as, I'm going to put an end to this.
Which would probably come as a huge shock to a family member who's like, they're better though.
Right.
And then if they try to take their life, would be really hard for family to deal with, I'm sure.
Yeah, because they've seen the hope, yeah.
Man, that's crazy.
So once a person does contemplate suicide, how quickly can they act on that thought?
Well, they can act on it quickly or slowly, depending on the means available to them and, you know, what what they plan, what their plan is. Okay. So, for example, if a person is looking at taking their lives with a weapon, if the weapon's not available, it could take a while. Mm-hmm. And so that's always one of the first things you do is make sure there's no weapon available to them. So trying to put those things aside and gives makes them find time to think it through. One of the common ways of people taking their lives is through crashing their car, which is why we don't even have a good count on the number of people who do take their lives. And so if they are really upset and angry, and they, that's where that anger sometimes can be a little bit scary, is they may get in their car and just go, and it's more like, I'm going to prove, you know, I'm going to show you, I'm going to do this almost to punish somebody. And, so that's a scary situation when they do it that way. Uh-huh. Others go to elaborate means of you know, they get the pills, they try to find ways to take their lives. They may dress up, they may, you know, decide they're going to go out in style, and it may be quite elaborate. There are some situations that people don't, you know, they don't think about it, but they still kind of think through the plan, but they don't quite carry it out because there's so much time in between. Uh-huh. That other things happen that get in the way. But it can, you know, it can certainly be a slow process, or it can be a very, very sudden and quick. The more lethal processes, you know, are the ones that are quick.
Right. Right. Well, you talked about the means a little bit. You know, some of the things I've been reading about, I think there's a little more research on that side of it, on the means side of suicide, mm-hmm. that it does matter.
It does.
That lethality, you know, and so talk about that a little bit about how important the means of suicide are, and does the attempt method have anything to do with success, so to speak?
Well, certainly. If somebody shoots themselves, then they're more likely to you know, to carry it out, and they're more likely to die, and they won't have time. The biggest thing is, do they have time to be rescued? And if somebody's taking, is going to overdrink or overdrug, they have some time to be rescued. And sometimes they will make a call to be rescued because they realize that's not what I want to do. Mm-hmm. An example, though, of a person who use more lethal, approaches are people who jump. And the most common place to jump is the Golden Gate Bridge. You know, it's the suicide capital, or the suicide spot. And they have records of people who, like 7 or 8 people who jumped and didn't die. And every one of them had one thing in common, and that was the minute they did it, they wish they hadn't done it. Uh-huh. And so I think that should give a big signal to the rest of us that, you know, most people don't really... Once they do it, they really didn't want to do it. Uh-huh. And if we can just get to them in time, then we can really truly save their lives.
Uh-huh. So it seems like, you know, if as a helper, if there seems to be an acute pressing need, like if you know someone is in a suicidal mode, that getting those lethal means out
absolutely
would be really crucial, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, which I know is a hard conversation because, you know, I actually heard a talk on this a couple of years ago where, you know, it was in the state of Texas, which is big pro-gun, and a lady from the Northeast came in and was talking about this, and she was trying to walk around it gingerly, but the gun lobby and all that, and it has nothing to do with gun rights. It's like, it's just, it will kill you quicker.
That's right.
Yeah, and so getting those out is super important in those situations.
Right. Now, when talking about teenagers and suicide, are there things that we see with teens that are different than maybe adults who try to take their life? Like, are there differences in thought means? Do they try different things? How does that look?
Teenagers don't have the experience that adults do. Adults can look at it long term. And one of the advantages of getting older is that, you know, things will eventually work out in the long term. The highest suicide rates are with teens and with the older population. Mm-hmm. Older populations are looking at it very much like teens, in that they are looking at, my health is bad, I don't see an end to this, so I'm going to take my life. And so the older population is high risk, but the teenagers don't have that perspective where they can say, oh, this is going to get better, because everything is in the present. It's all about right now.
Right.
And their brains haven't developed enough to know, to handle more than two or three things at a time. So they can't reason out the way adults can and the way we can. We can say, okay, this is the problem. I can take my life, or I could just, get a good night's rest and see how things will go. Or I can start, I can go see a therapist. We have all these options that we can think through, but teenagers don't think through as well as adults. And I think adults, just with experience, know that if you wait, things get a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
And we often try to help teens to be patient. That's part of the process. That's one reason they drive too fast. They also think they're invincible, even though they want to take their lives, they don't really see it as the end.
Right.
Because they can, they'll drive and they'll be in a car wreck, but they'll be like that guy on TV who survived.
Mm-hmm.
And they won't be the one who doesn't. Or, even I think that's one reason we have problems with shootings. It's not about, I don't think people realize that death is death. And teenage years are not quite as understanding of the fact that it is the end.
The finality of death.
The finality, right.
Well, still, it's the childlike side of adolescence. Like, you're both adult and child going right through that. As I think about, we're talking about death. I think about my five-year-old. He talks about, someone dying or whatever. He does not get that is done.
Right,
Right. And but an adult does. I mean, because we know when someone dies, they're gone. And so
right,
that's such a hard thing for a teenager. I think that's a great observation. This is where the child side of the brain still is, mm-hmm, is taken over. So let's get practical for a few minutes here, and let's talk about, the doing side, what we can do, which I know you're big on that.
Mm-hmm.
So if one of our listeners suspects that their student or a student that they're working with is suicidal, what are some kind of first steps they can take to help that student?
Well, I think, especially for teachers and our people in the community, I think the big thing is to know your resources,
mm-hmm,
just to know there are people out there who can help. It can be any mental health specialist, but probably the most practical person is your physician.
Hmm.
And because that person also has access to lots of community people that will be, who are experts in that area. If it's a teacher in school, going directly to the school counselor, asking that person about, who is a person that could help with the student, or I've got a concern. And that school counselor immediately has her own his own approach to going in and assessing whether or not it's something to be concerned about.
Mm-hmm.
I think the most important part at the beginning is just knowing your resources. And there's always, there's a suicide hotline that people can call when they are suicidal. Sometimes it's the fastest way to get assistance.
Mm-hmm.
There's also, but if you are with someone who is suicidal, calling 911 is definitely your next step.
Right.
And they are trained to handle that kind of crisis.
Mm-hmm.
I think the if you are with that person, talking with the person, and just finding out what's going on is important. A lot of times we make assumptions without asking, and we just assume, well, they look sad, I wonder if they're suicidal, or they just look sad, and we don't think about that. I have learned over the years that suicide, I keep that in the front of my mind now when I'm talking to someone who seems like they're in trouble, and it doesn't mean I always ask them, but if I think it's getting serious enough that they are, I'm going to ask, are you thinking about killing yourself?
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean they're going to go out and do it because I asked them.
Mm-hmm. You're not planning an idea.
I'm not planning an idea.
Yeah.
They haven't found any evidence to say that plant's an idea.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that we have to be sure to not be afraid of asking it. It's hard to ask,
mm-hmm,
but when you're thinking about asking it, or if you know you're going to meet with someone who might be like that, who might be in that situation, just practice saying it out loud to yourself. Mm-hmm. You know, are you thinking about killing yourself? It's uncomfortable, but it's a lot more uncomfortable to find out if they went out and tried it.
Right.
So we want to get them help really quickly. I think the other thing that can be helpful is to ask other people around about how they see the person. You know, have you seen anything different about them? Or that way you find out if it's a situation that just in that situation, that person was feeling bad and not doing well and they got over it and they went on. Or is this something that they've seen pervasively over many days or over different circumstances? So, but I still think it goes right back to asking the person, mm-hmm. how are you doing? What's going on? And first of all, it just says, you know, I care about you and I am concerned. But it also gives them an opportunity to give you that feedback. And you'd be surprised how many people will say, I thought about it, but I won't do it. And that's like, that's a relief, mm-hmm. but you just want to know if they're even thinking about it. And how far has that gone?
Right.
Now, on the flip side, is there something that helpers need to not say? Is there something that could cause harm or in that moment that we need to stay away from?
I think there are definitely things that are inappropriate, like, oh, you wouldn't do that. Hmm. Or, you know, probably the worst thing is what you don't say, which is not asking, not even talking about it,
right.
Trying to avoid it. Or giving them a lecture. Oh, you don't want to do that, you know. Things are always going to be better, blah, blah, blah. You know, lectures can be helpful, but that's not the time. Mm. At that point, if they are saying, I'm thinking about killing myself, then they are really, they're in a crisis. And so I think in a crisis, you think about how would you deal with someone who just been in an earthquake? You know, how would you intervene? You wouldn't sit there and say, now let me tell you, this is going to be fine. It's all going to work out. We're going to mm-hmm. get you food and shelter and it's all going to be fine and blah, blah, blah. But they're not in that point. You know, they're in shock. Mm-hmm. And this person is in a similar place. They're not mentally thinking the way they would normally think. And they're in a crisis. And so we have to approach that with listening more and asking questions out of our interest in them. Mm-hmm. You know, how are you doing? What are some things that you've tried? What's been helpful to you? What are some things I can do to help you? And I think that always makes a difference, because if you ask that question, then the person knows they're not in it by themselves.
Right.
I think one of the things with teenagers that's different from adults, and I thought of this a while ago, Chris, when you were talking, is they have not seen the pain of the family members when someone dies. Mm-hmm. Often they haven't had that experience of death like other people have. And so they don't realize the ramifications of them dying, what that might do to the family. Mm-hmm. And so I think letting them know that you care about them and how much they mean to you makes a difference.
Well, you know, and this is such an aside, but I think it goes right to your point is, you know, we do try to protect our kids from those hard things. You know, I know of families who they go to church funerals. Mm-hmm. That's a big part of their family, mm-hmm. you know, rhythm, and not people they don't know, but
sure.
They make sure that their kids go to those things so they know, you know, everything that goes into that process and
right.
how difficult death can be. And, you know, when your only experience with death has been on TV, mm-hmm. Or social media or whatever that looks like, it's not very real. It's detached in some way. And
right.
so,
right.
I don't know if in some roundabout way that helps with this whole conversation, you know, mm-hmm. but just students knowing that, you know, death is final, it's real, it affects so many people, it's not isolated.
Right.
It's a community thing. Like it's families, community, it's all of us, you know?
Right. Right. I think that's a good point. We don't learn to get through things without having other people around. And that's one of the things that going to a funeral, you find out that, it also is a support system. Mm-hmm. And for children, learning how to deal with difficult times with their parents there to help them is really important, mm-hmm. you know, because they're going to go through those times and it's going to be a lot worse if they haven't had that kind of support system mm-hmm. in the past. So the more supports they can get going through a crisis, the stronger they'll be.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take that into just another question we have. We're talking about it already, but obviously suicide is a hard thing to talk about. You mentioned before about just asking that question is so difficult. You know, what can we do to destigmatize this really difficult topic?
I think the biggest thing is to just talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
I think keeping it in the, you know, not being afraid to discuss it. If other people are talking about it, listening, taking it seriously,
mm-hmm.
even if they're, I mean, if they're just discussing it as a topic, I think that's such an important part of just not being afraid of it. Keeping people aware of it, that sort of an education type of approach where people are aware that suicide is a problem and we need to be always on top of it when we're thinking about other people who are in trouble. What can we do? How can we let them know that we care about them and that we see that they might have something that they need?
So you've already mentioned some of these things, but specifically, what can families do to better support teenagers who maybe are contemplating suicide or have already told a family member, I've thought about it? What are those next steps? How can they better support that teen?
I think one of the first things to do, and I tell this to most anybody who is having a serious mental health issue, is I think they need to see their physician. Because a lot of times, just physical problems can cause people to think irrationally and not think clearly. And I think if they can go see a doctor and make sure they don't have any type of blood sugar problems, thyroid problems, you know, talk about things that are physical issues for them, I think a lot of times that gets that out of the way. A lot of times people will quit eating or they quit exercising. And those are, of course, important to having a good ability to think clearly.
Mm-hmm.
But if they but sometimes those things are caused by physical problems. And so if we can address that first. And getting a doctor's opinion is also helpful,
mm-hmm.
I think. I think making sure that you're available. As a parent, I know we're busy and we have lots of things that are going on in our lives, but being available to your teen so that they can talk to you. And it's really hard, as anyone knows, to sit down and say, tell me about your day. How was it? Fine. And so they just sort of, you know, what did you do? Nothing. And what did you learn? Nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's hard to get a conversation going sometimes with a teen. They need to be able to talk to you about mm-hmm. things. And so even if it's, I think, going for a ride in the car, I think parents who take their kids to school, it's great because it's an opportunity for them to talk about things that are bothering them. It's also an opportunity to get a read on how they're doing. Going on vacations together where there's no pressure to be anybody or anything, just to be together is really important. Parents, just, you know, talking with a child while you're washing dishes can be such a help, just because it gives them an opportunity to open up without you even having eye contact. Mm. We always talk about eye contact, but a lot of times working with kids, they don't need eye contact. They just need to know that you're hearing them.
Mm-hmm.
So leaning in and just listening without making them feel ashamed or embarrassed, because a lot of things that happen in school are embarrassing or shaming. Being bullied is not something people are proud of. And so mm-hmm. if they're having a problem with a bully, they're more likely to tell you that. If you're driving around the car or you're sitting there late at night watching television and y'all are together and lights are off and just things are quieter and easier to visit. Almost surreal, but it's mm-hmm. when we speak up the most.
Right, right. So one last thing, just as we talked about what can families do better. How can the local, we'll just kind of focus on the school here because you'd already kind of mentioned this, but how can schools do a better job preventing getting the conversation going about suicide?
I think one of the best things that we've uncovered in the past past several years has been the value of peers and peer support. And so not only opening up about talking about suicide with adults, but getting peers to be aware of it. Peers are the first people who will hear if a person is thinking about taking their life. And getting peers to learn the importance of reporting that to someone. Mm-hmm. We do that with bullies. We need to do that also with people who are suicidal. Mm-hmm. And having them report to whoever they want, any adult, that, you know, I heard Jack talking about taking his life and I wanted you to know about it. Or, mm-hmm. you know, Martha's got a razor blade and she's talking about slitting her wrist. And we often take that as they don't really, aren't going to really do it. But even I know people who have slit their wrists and died. And so it's just an important thing for the teens to be able to talk about each other and, to an adult and have some trusted adults that they can go to. It can be confidential because mm-hmm. the issue is not about what the person said. It's about the person who's talking about doing it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it's really important to me. They are the best resources we have, but we have to teach adults as well to be open to hearing that and being open to asking that person if they are thinking about taking their lives.
I love that. It's so simple, but can make such a big impact too if we mm-hmm. use the teenagers and the peers that care about them. Mm-hmm. So Dr. Taylor, we have two final questions that we want to ask to kind of wrap up today. But the first one is, what is one thing you would want to say to a teenager who's maybe contemplating suicide?
I would want to tell them that you're not alone, that even when you feel like it, that you're not alone. People care about you. It may not seem like it right now, but give them time. If you need to find help, there's always help. But just remember how important and how impactful it would be if you took your life, how that would impact other people. And you people care about you, and to know that they didn't do something to help you would be really difficult for them as well. So even in our own struggles, we need to think about how do we impact other people.
Mm-hmm. And finally, what's one thing you would want one of our listeners to hear from everything we talked about today, which is a lot? We talked about a lot of good stuff today, but what's one thing you feel like is the most important?
Just be available. Mm-hmm. Be available and be willing to listen, to hear what people are saying when they when they're thinking about it. Just keeping it on the forefront of your mind. The more I've worked in this area, the more important it is, I see, to when I'm talking with people, to always keep that foremost in my thoughts, so that maybe I can do something to intervene.
This is the university for us, for the student scholars, for the tenacious ones who seek to discover new depths in their field, for the pioneers in math, theology, nursing, and education. This is the university for those seeking truth in every discipline. This is the university for you. Lubbock Christian University.
Well, Chris, I don't know about you, but I loved everything that Becky said and just what she brought and some things that I hadn't even thought about. The one thing that really stood out to me probably was at the beginning when she talked about if a teenager has had someone close to them die by suicide, that is a huge risk factor. Mm-hmm. I think she says at one point, like, watch them. Watch that. If they have had a family member, a friend, a parent especially, that is something that you need to watch mm-hmm. and be very mindful of and have conversations about, instead of just being like, oh, because they've had someone die by suicide, that's not going to be a risk factor for them. It's kind of the opposite of maybe what you'd even think.
Mm-hmm. And probably for most of us, we don't realize how prevalent that is in most people's lives. Like, most of us know someone or maybe once removed from someone who died by suicide. And so likely teenagers have either, you know, been close to something like that, or maybe have seen some of that on social media. And so, yeah, absolutely, that loss is a huge thing. And I think you know, she talked about, you know, suicide also being connected with some kind of a loss. That kind of that spurs that. And we've talked about this on some other podcast about the idea of loss, that it looks different for a student than often it does for adults. Mm-hmm. It might not for, and I guess for adults, really, we talked about this in the grief episode with Beverly, I believe, Beverly Ross. Loss can be a breakup or a major disappointment or something that we as an adult would look at that and like, that's not that big of a deal.
Right. A sports injury or mm-hmm. something, not necessarily even a death.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah, the sports injury thing is huge because, you know, you think about the hopes and dreams of student athletes and they might be thinking they're going to the NFL or getting scholarships and they blow out their knee in their senior year. Changes everything.
Right.
When everything was hinging on that. And so that's an important thing when there is some kind of loss, when you perceive that your student has, or a student that you work with has lost something, not necessarily thinking, oh, they're going to go commit, you know, die by suicide or think about it, but keeping an extra eye, close watch on how they're feeling. Are there any changes in routine or feelings about things that they would normally be excited about, those kind of things.
Right. And Dr. Taylor even talks about if you suspect, if you're watching them and you're noticing changes, ask them, mm-hmm. have you thought about suicide? Mm-hmm. And maybe you don't have to ask that every single time, but if it gets to the point where you think maybe they are, mm-hmm. that needs to be a question that you are asking themselves. Should I ask about that? Mm-hmm. And she says, even in the research, that doesn't mean that you have planted that idea in their head. Mm-hmm. But that maybe that opens up conversation that maybe they say, no, I haven't at all. Mm-hmm. And then you can have a conversation about, okay, well, what are you feeling and what is happening? Mm-hmm. Or maybe they say, I've thought about it or I have a plan. And then you can go from there and know what steps you need to take rather than just kind of remaining oblivious to what's going on.
Well, and Dr. Taylor brings it up and Leslie does some next week as well. But really, I encourage the listener to kind of get this into your head. Don't be afraid of the question of, are you thinking about killing yourself? Practice it. If you're riding in the car right now, just saying those words, it feels a little weird coming out of your mouth because it's almost like you're affirming something that's horribly dark. But the research shows, and that's kind of where a lot of the practice is moving towards. And suicide education and research is that direct question, if you suspect something, is incredibly preventative because it kind of gets what is in the dark out into the light very quickly without a lot of pretense that everyone knows now. You know, I know something's going on. I don't know how bad this is, but I care about you enough just to get that question asked. I encourage you to get some training on that. There's some great brief trainings like QPR, question, persuade, refer. There's lifelines. It's in some of the school districts. There are lots of different ways you can get trained as a kind of a gatekeeper almost. You know, be prepared for this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm.
And I think it was interesting too when she talks about the difference of why suicide is so prevalent among teenagers, uh-huh. and that they just don't have this future. It's going to get better, mm-hmm. or it's been bad in the past, but I saw it get better, so I'm going to hang on. And for them, this is the end of the world. Mm-hmm. And she also mentions this kind of interesting deal with teenagers of they think, oh, I'm going to get in this car wreck, but I'm not actually going to die. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be the one that survives, and then I'll get all the attention or whatever that looks like. And they don't necessarily think dead is dead. Mm-hmm. And I think you even talked about Griffin and how with your son, death is not necessarily death. They don't get the finality of that mm-hmm. yet. And so having these conversations can bring up some of that as well. If you can be the adult that's like, it's going to get better. Mm-hmm. And maybe that doesn't need to be the first conversation you have. Maybe the first conversation is, I'm going to listen to you and you need to tell me what's going on, what's wrong, mm-hmm. without me saying, oh, here's how it's going to be better. Mm-hmm. But if you continue to have relationship, continue to have conversation with that teenager, you can get to a place where you can give hope mm-hmm. to and hopefully walk through that with them and say, you're not alone. And even though you're struggling, I'm going to be here with you the whole time.
Absolutely. Well, with suicide kind of going up the charts as one of the leading causes of death among teenagers. We're not okay with that. But we can do something about it by being better prepared with the questions we ask in our presence, and not allowing the students in our lives to go to those dark places by themselves. Those dark places exist. They're going to go there, but they don't have to go there alone.
The Don't Panic podcast is produced by Teen Life and Ricky Lewis. Your hosts are Chris Roby and Carly Duke. The intro music you heard today comes from Under the Chandeliers. You can find them on SoundCloud or Spotify, so go take a listen. If you want to check out today's notes and resources, visit our website, don'tpanicpodcast.org. Or you can find us on Twitter or Instagram at Don't Panic Talk. Thanks for listening, and remember, don't panic. You've got this.